You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel it now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of change.
Heads up. Mr. President, about the new plan broadening the FBI's powers, allowing them to open investigations, look into private records, conduct surveillance on American citizens without any basis for suspicion.
Yeah, personally, I'm sick of the whole probable cause thing. Americans should be honored. Don't look at it as the end of privacy. Look at it as your government's into you. They think you're hot. They want to know more about you. You just got a new friend request from your government, and you better accept, because we're coming in anyway.
And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
Hello and welcome to this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. For 3 years now, the show has been bringing you news and information the six mega corporations that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio do not want you to know. Just like the news not reported about what happened to the RNC in St. Paul 10 days ago when the police went on a riot, especially targeting journalists, the reason you did not hear about this is because it did not fit into their mold, their sanitized little worldview that they want to show you. So if you like your news and information spoon-fed to you by the corporate handlers, then this is not the place for you. If you appreciate alternative media from a non-corporate perspective, then this is the right place. If you listened to last week's show, you would know that I was among the many, many people arrested and placed in Ramsey County Jail for 56 hours and then just released, without having to sign a bond, without being charged with anything, just released. Last week I brought you a little bit about what happened to other people that were there. I want to start out this week's show with a little reminder of what went down in St. Paul last week and the targeting of indie media journalists. So here is this week's 5-minute segment, Media Minutes, who will talk about what happened in St. Paul during the RNC. After that, I'll be back to talk about the specifics of my arrest. As always, I'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen to this fully independent, non-corporate radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Thanks for listening.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The group that's assembled here today represents Twin Cities journalists, independent media makers, and others who care deeply about press freedom. We have brought with us the support of more than 50,000 Americans to deliver St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman a message. Mayor Coleman, journalism is not a crime.
Last week, journalists and citizens of St. Paul, Minnesota, gathered at St. Paul City Hall to demand that charges be dropped for all journalists arrested while covering the Republican National Convention. Nancy Doyle Brown of the Twin Cities Media Alliance led the charge that delivered more than 50,000 letters collected by nonpartisan media reform group Free Press.
Over the past week, journalists have been detained and arrested, subjected to raids, pepper sprayed, and more simply for showing up to work. These have been dark days for press freedom in the United States.
Journalists were in St. Paul to report on the RNC, both inside the Excel Center and out in the streets. Reporters with Eyewitness Video, a New York-based video collective, were held at gunpoint during a preemptive raid aimed at disrupting protesters. During the convention, journalists were swept up in mass arrests with protesters and bystanders, detained for several hours to several days, and had their equipment confiscated. Some were roughed up by police. Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman, Sharif Abdel-Quddus, and Nicole Salazar also attended the petition drop. All three were among those arrested. Salazar filmed her own arrest.
I was telling them that I'm press, please let me pass. And one of the officers, I think he was trying to drag me, he was grabbing my leg. And another officer put his boot on my back and was pressing me to the ground.
Also among the arrested were two filmmakers from Pepper Spray Productions, Joseph Lissac and Lambert Rochford. Rochford, who was also arrested during the 2004 RNC, says that independent journalists aren't taken as seriously as mainstream journalists, and they are seen as more of a threat.
Journalists who are independent, who aren't, like, you know, affiliated with a big, like, corporate news outlet, and who are choosing to cover things that the state would rather not get media attention, such as, you know, protest, it tend to be targeted by the police because they see us as a threat to their ideology. I mean, we're putting out media that's contrary to what they want people to know about and believe.
But mainstream journalists were also arrested. Among them, Associated Press photographer Matt Rourke, a reporter from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and several other local journalists and photographers. Mike Busco of the Minnesota Newspaper Guild was appalled by the heavy-handed treatment of journalists.
The convention happens inside and outside. It's an event. And if journalists are not free to do their jobs, then the democracy is not served.
Jason Barnett of The Uptake, a group of citizen video journalists, said that those reporting on an event should not be arrested for unlawful assembly.
The police would say, disperse, and you have 10 minutes to disperse or whatever. And the assumption is that if you're a journalist, you know, from the police, that you're supposed to disperse. Well, if you disperse when they tell you to, then you're not covering the story. The journalists really are supposed to stay there at that time.
Back up!
Are we all going to die by firing squad? What?
Get on the bridge!
I'm trying to leave peacefully! Help me leave!
Geraldine Cahill of The Real News was arrested with her videographer. She gave this report.
One officer told me while I was sitting on the bridge that the media can embed themselves with police and not get into trouble. Does this sound familiar? So much for the Fourth Estate.
Special thanks to The Uptake, Democracy Now!, St. Paul Pioneer Press, and The Real News for their audio clips. For links to these clips and more, go to freepress.net/media minutes. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
So there you have a review of what went down in St. Paul during the RNC. Not known outside the few programs such as listeners to this show and a few others, but definitely not covered on the mainstream media at all. Even shows like Coast to Coast AM, who love to talk about government conspiracies, will not talk about this one. Last week, Coast to Coast was hosted out of St. Paul and had nothing but praise for the St. Paul and told his audience of 5-minute listeners that Amy Goodman was the only journalist arrested. Again, Coast to Coast is nothing but a conspiracy-driven show, from UFOs to Bigfoot, but not this conspiracy. Why did Eden Punnett of Coast to Coast spin it so well? Well, with his 5 million nightly listeners, he needs to keep the corporate handlers happy. The same group of people who sponsored the RNC. The same group who paid for the first $10 million of civil suits from the police misconduct. Yep, as reported last week, if you're listening, the first $10 million of any police misconduct by the St. Paul Police Department will be paid by the private backers of the RNC. So big business is renting out police brutality. And again, the same corporate interests who profit from Coast to Coast are the same people who are paying for the RNC and DNC. That's why Ian Punnett of Coast to Coast will not talk about this conspiracy. And that's why Main Street media will not cover this either, because they are the same people who are profiting from the RNC and DNC. They are the same people who are sponsoring the RNC and the DNC. They have a very vested interest in keeping things status quo. Well, back to the rest then. My primary objective was to go to St. Paul to get interviews for my show. It wasn't the only objective, but it was the one I wanted to do the most. If you listened to last week's show, you know that I was rounded up too, stripped, forced to spread my cheeks, put in the funny pajamas, and put into 23-hour lockdown for 56 hours, and then, just like hundreds of us, just released. No bail, no signing anything, no charges, just released. I'd been advised that I can't speak at all, really, about the specifics of my arrest, at least not at this time. So let's put this on some very general items. If you listen to last week's show, you know eyewitness video. One time a warrant was issued to them, and they took them down for 2 hours looking for something. I'm not sure what, obviously not found, didn't arrest them that time. The next day they came into their offices looking for, quote, a hostage situation. Someone reported, not in a 911 call where it actually be recorded so we could find out, you know, if the police are lying or not, but a special line. And supposedly eyewitness video storefront had hostages being held by anarchists, which, of course, is just a bogus reason to harass them. There's been other reports as well that sometimes the police, instead of getting warrants when they busted into buildings, would just claim that there's a wanted fugitive reported in there. And that's the reason why they can just bust down the door and come in without a warrant. So these kind of things happened all the time. Again, if you listen to last week's show, you would have heard all that on other reports by other media. Again, I'm not allowed to talk about specifics of my arrest, so I'm not going to go into that, but I can talk about the situation that happens in jail and the harassment and well, if you listen to last week's show, you'd know some people are definitely tortured. So I did want to do a little bit, just quickly talking about the jail itself and how basically you're screwed if you're a poor person in this country. First thing I want to mention is that this young woman I came in with was, her mouth was forced open with a unsanitized pliers to get at her piercing, her tongue piercing that she had. She was also released with no charges, with nothing, about 2 hours before I was, and I was able to talk to her, and she's okay. But she had to, she eventually convinced the cop not to cut it out, that she would try to pull it through herself. So that's the kind of treatment that you were getting in jail. They had a 23-hour lockdown, and about the 23rd hour, they actually let me out and tried to make my first phone call. The first groups that got out tried calling the legal line, which is set up for activists to call with their information, so they can call and say, hey, here I am, here are the numbers, and here are the people you need to contact. Well, that legal line was jammed by the police department or by the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department for the longest time. I eventually got out, I think about maybe the 30th hour or so, was able to get in touch with the legal line and get more information out there. By the way, when you make a phone call from the jail, apparently you can't call cell phones. You can only call hard lines. So again, if you're a poor person in this country and you really only have, or your family only has a choice and the wherewithal to have either a hard line or a cell phone line, most people are going to go with cell phone lines. So again, that's just another way of, you know, making it rougher poor people in this country. When they put us in jail, they outright admitted that they ran out of blankets, so we didn't get any blankets. And the long list of items that you're supposed to get when you're in jail was not given to us, including blankets, two pencils, 5 sheets of paper, legal documents are allowed to keep. None of that stuff was given to us. No vending card for the vending machines, that was just there. And again, a needless 23-hour lockdown in the cell. Also, the lights were kept on 24 hours a day. Now, I know they could dim them because they dimmed them for a little while once. But the top bunk person just basically had to suffer through having a light about a foot from his face all night long, or her face if it's in a woman's pod. When you do finally get released, again, majority of the people that I was put in with, I think over 200 of them that I know of, just got released with no bail requirements, no hearing, all that kind of stuff. When you do get it, they give you a check for the money you came in with. And that check cannot be cashed for 24 hours. So again, if you're a poor person, they take away all your cash. And let's say you don't have credit cards or ATM machines like I'm affluent enough to do and go to the store and just take some money out to get on the bus to go home or you know, get money just to call someone, basically. Well, if you're a poor person, you get a check that you don't get the cash for 24 hours. Now, my specific situation is that I had a car that was parked in a legal spot on that Monday, was a holiday. But on Tuesday, since it's still in jail, it got towed away. So let me tell you what they do when they tow away cars. When they tow away cars, you got to get it from a private impound. Well, the cost of getting that car back for having it stored one night and towed away was $471.75. Now, again, if you got a junker, if you're a poor person, you know, you're not going to go and get that car out of there because it's $50 a day. So if you're in jail for like a week and finally able to get it out of impound, you know, your car doesn't, often the cars won't have enough value to make it worth it. Not only that, but you got to bring the exact cash. You can't bring checks or credit cards to get your thing out. So again, if you're a poor person, you got to go round up $471.75. And it has to be exact cash. I showed up with $480, and they're like, oh, sorry, you don't have the exact cash. You're just out of luck. You can't get your card until you bring us the exact cash. So that kind of bureaucracy and hassling of poor people is really, really unfortunate if you are incarcerated in any kind of jails these days. And I think it's a pretty horrific event just generally. But again, if you're a person of limited means, well, it's even more so. Lastly, let's talk about the 56 hours that I was held, and many people are held that long. You're only allowed to be held for 36 hours without being charged, and when you get charged, that often means you get to post bail. So most people thought they'd get out after 36 hours. What people do not understand in this country is that holidays and weekends don't count. So I was arrested on Monday. My clock doesn't start until midnight, Monday night, Tuesday morning. That's when my clock starts ticking. Now, it's still that still doesn't add up. I was held more than 36 hours. That's because a judge allowed an extension of 12 hours for everybody. Everybody could be held an extra 12 hours. And that's why I was released about 2 hours before the 48 hours of my time I was allowed to be in there. And, of course, I was in there 8 hours before that at 2 o'clock or so in the afternoon was when I was first arrested. So the people that they preemptively arrested on Friday night, the Friday before that, well, they got totally screwed because they were not going to get, they don't get any time for Saturday, no time for Sunday, and no time for Monday. So many of those people got preemptively arrested on Friday, finally got out Tuesday about noon before the judge gave that 12-hour extension. So some of them got out then. So again, that's just one more thing about the system. Big cities, you would think they would have some kind of weekend court or night court set up, holiday court set up or whatever, but of course they don't. So if you're a poor person, you're just out of luck because you're not going to get arraigned. You're not going to get your day in court until 36 hours, and if the judge wants to extend it to 48 hours, apparently, that's all okay. Again, I'm a former Marine. Basic training taught me how to put up with a lot of crap. Being uncomfortable and bored does not scare me. Some people in my pod and other cell blocks did start to lose it a bit, especially those who were mistreated and not given any information for like 48 hours and not released, not understanding that they're going to do everything they can legally and a lot of illegal stuff to make their lives as miserable as possible. There, of course, should be an investigation into all this. There never will be, of course. Not even the outrage of a person obviously targeted by the police, someone somewhat powerful, Amy Goodman, arrested with her 1,000-plus radio stations, will not be enough tension to have anything really ever happen. Yes, there will be civil lawsuits won by many, many of the 818-plus that were arrested in St. Paul. Again, just the cost of doing business, however. But let's make sure we fully understand what that means. In the eyes of authority who are supposed to enforce the laws in this country, it is okay to stifle dissent and the media all at the beckoning call of corporations. Police do not need to follow the laws and will not be held accountable. Again, just the cost of doing business. One last thing, and I kind of hate to say this with all the good work that Amy Goodman did, but I'm really, really sick of the media thinking that they are somehow more privileged than anybody else. Notice I never played the media card, though I think that they were targeting me as well for my efforts with my show. I am no more special than any other person wrongly arrested and mistreated. The fact that Amy Goodman only was in jail for something like 12 hours and all of us were in for jail for up to 5 times that amount is not right. It means that the media, and even alternative media, feels that there are special people in this world who deserve special consideration and treatment. We already know the rich feel this way. Now the media too, I guess. Amy Goodman and all the journalists there did not deserve any more special treatment than anyone else got who was illegally arrested. We are all in the same boat, and we all deserve to be treated equally. I don't care if you're a rich person or a media person. Isn't that what we're all really fighting for anyways?
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
It started last night at 9:15 when cops raided this old movie theater in St. Paul, a space they say was set up by an anarchist group called the RNC Welcoming Committee.
Police came running in and told everyone to get down on the ground, and lay down on the ground with a variety of weapons in their hands. So everyone did that, and they told us that they had a warrant to search the building, but they didn't show us a warrant, or read us a warrant, and then they proceeded to yell and tell people to put their faces into the ground.
They ended up breaking through the door.
all of us were in there. They had us get down on our stomachs as we were watching a movie.
Screaming, get on the floor, get on the floor, get on the floor. You know, it was frightening. Absolutely frightening.
Tell you what, go. You tell me when these braces get too tight, right? Ah! Just like that.
Later, around 8 in the morning, cops raided 3 houses in South Minneapolis and arrested 5 people.
That those individuals were being charged with conspiracy to commit riots. And according to the Hennepin County jail records, they're being held on probable cause, which means they were not, no formal charge has been issued, no complaint has been reviewed or signed by a prosecutor or a judge. They can be held on probable cause until Wednesday at 12 noon. In my view, this is a preventive detention action by the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department.
Arson! 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 Arson!
Police terror alert! Police terror alert! Code red! Code red!
I don't know if you can see it from there. Wow!
Must be listening. And when they arrest people, they're stopping those who are check and balance on power. It is so important that we be allowed to do our work and that people be allowed to express themselves, whether or not they're journalists, freely and peacefully. That didn't happen today. Nicole Salazar was dragged by her leg by police. She is a Democracy Now! Producer. She had a camera. She was videoing this. She videoed her own arrest.
Muslims are not terrorists! Muslims are not terrorists! Muslims are not terrorists!
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Bob Woodward, tireless scribe to the powerful, has a new book with stunning revelations like the fact that the United States has been spying on Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. In other news, George Bush is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, the Republicans sometimes lie, and the sun frequently rises in the east. According to Woodward, the surge is not primarily responsible for the success in Iraq. Apparently, nameless high-tech methods, described by the president as awesome, have enabled much better targeting of insurgents in Iraq. The U.S. military is engaged in a war of words about how many innocents were slaughtered in the small Afghan village of Azizabad. The military says 5 to 7 civilians and 30 to 35 insurgents were killed. Every other observer, including the villagers, officials from the Afghan government and human rights organizations, and UN investigators, say over 90 civilians, the majority of them women and children, were killed. U.S. forces have been involved in ground raids in Pakistan, supplementing their frequent random airstrikes. The United States has officially turned over responsibility for security in Al-Anbar province to the Iraqi government, along with responsibility for pay of the remaining awakening militias. The only criticisms of the Iraq war heard in recent months from Democratic politicians are that we need to pull soldiers out of Iraq, where they've been successful, to Afghanistan, where they're needed, and that we need to pull soldiers out of Iraq because they've done their job, but the Iraqis have shirked their duties and must be forced to be more self-reliant, not shiftless, lazy, and ungrateful for all that has been done for them. Everything that one sees or hears just rounds out the dominant narrative that the United States has finally succeeded in Iraq. Republicans say the success is fragile and must be nurtured by lots of Americans with guns, while the Democrats say it's robust. A bipartisan consensus seems to have evolved on a need for U.S. escalation in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Although Barack Obama was ahead of John McCain on this one because of the convenient fact that he had opposed the Iraq War and could thus convincingly portray Iraq as the bad war and Afghanistan as the good one, McCain, the Bush administration, and the military are all on the same page as him now. It's gotten to the point where there's almost nothing interesting to say about U.S. foreign policy anymore. One can point to relatively more minor matters like U.S. adventurism regarding Georgia, but about the two wars the United States is currently waging, there is a rigid lockstep. Indeed, the only thing that keeps an atmosphere of triumphalism from emerging and engulfing everything is the increasingly non-substantive partisan divide. The Democrats still have to make noises about Iraq and about how the U.S. strategy isn't quite working, even though they don't seem to believe what they're saying. And Obama still pulls some sleight of hand about complete U.S. withdrawal, although that has become utterly implausible. What person within the whole foreign policy establishment would countenance abandoning Iraq to a ferociously anti-American and pro-Iranian government when there is no force capable of making the United States leave? The military is under strain because of the enhanced deployment schedule necessitated by the surge, but that's far from becoming a serious problem. To the extent that it is, there'll be gradual drawdowns in the troop numbers. With the extremely low casualty rates coming out of Iraq and complete public passivity about the war in the United States, there is no particular reason for the government to change its strategies. After all the Sturm und Drang of the past few years, the large numbers turning out to oppose the war, the delegitimization of everything the Bush administration has done, the emergence of militant organized liberalism, the collapse of the easy support for U.S. military intervention that has prevailed ever since the Gulf War, what a strange state of affairs we've come to. Seemingly excessively stormy waters that, on closer examination, turn out to be a dead calm. And yet, what depraved monster would wish on any country the success that Iraq has been subject to? If there were an anti-war movement left, its task would be to save Afghanistan and Pakistan from any similar successes. Will another one rise? I'm not going to hold my breath. But then holding your breath isn't the best way to change things anyway. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Heads up.
Vice President Cheney, in Iraq, KBR and its Jordanian subcontractor have been charged with human trafficking, kidnapping workers from Nepal and sending them against their will to work for KBR in Iraq. Sadly, many of them were killed by Iraqi insurgents.
Well, we had, slaves to help start our democracy. KBR is just, helping show Iraq the, American way.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
I'm with another gentleman here who's at the anti-Nazi protests. And I want
this is Mike Cannon. I'm with Becca, who has returned from Palestine for the fourth time.
I'm with a vendor at the energy fair here who has biodiesel.
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with a group, the RNC Welcoming Committee for the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up.
Anita's still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So
stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And you too can stay current by checking out the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m. on this, your only not-for-profit, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Okay, to the top of the hour, we'll be hearing the weekly news and review segment from the folks at Eat the State. After that will be a segment I produce for the alternative radio world Ether Out There, This Week in Radical History. And that should take us to the top of the hour. As always, I'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen to this little show. Thanks for listening.
No, I'm not waiting around while you have all the fun. Now, come on, are you going to just stand there all day?
You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle and on the web at kexp.org. It is 8:30 and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you both back.
Thank you.
So starting, instead of starting out with local, we're going to start out with the big item today, which of course is Ike.
Yeah, we will bring this back to local, trust me on this, but wanted to start with Ike for people who are just getting up or haven't been listening. It did hit into Galveston and has passed over Houston overnight last night. It's very frightening to see what could happen because, you know, Houston, Galveston, that's a major metropolitan area. It's larger than Seattle. It's about 4.5 million people in that area. And they're really hurting this morning.
Yeah, they're entirely without power. The plan, when I was reading about the preparations for Hurricane Ike, I was reading, you know, that these people have to stay put, that the only reinsurances they were given was that, you know, some 5 million ready meals are on the way. That's going to feed what 4.5 million people once. You know, I mean, that's not even going to cover their needs for a day. So I'm looking at this thinking, well, it's not so much what's going on local. It's what's going on at the federal level for emergency planning and preparedness. And unfortunately, it's exactly the same thing we saw with Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah,
what
absolutely.
We saw with the Bush administration, even trying to do planning or no planning, that is, for the war in Iraq. It's basically let's just let it happen. Then leave the outcome to private contractors to deal with. We'll throw a lot of taxpayer money at it. Much of that's going to disappear into contractors' pockets. They're going to provide little or no services to the people who need it, and a lot of people will suffer.
And after 3 years after Katrina, FEMA is still being run by political hacks, and FEMA in turn is a subset of the Department of Homeland Security, which is still run by Michael Chertoff, who was really criminally negligent during Katrina, and he still has that same job 3 years later.
So yeah, so what I'm afraid is that we're going to see in the coming days that it's exactly the same story as Katrina, a lot of misery and not a lot of help from the outside. So the lesson we learn here in Seattle is that if we have a natural disaster, we're going to be pretty much on our own, I think.
Yeah, I think it's that way across the country. Mm-hmm. The other thing about Galveston is it's home to one of the five biosafety level 4 labs in the country, you know, and you have to question the wisdom of, oh, let's put one of the nastiest
yes.
things in the
cited
U.S.
cited actually where I used to work at the University of Texas Medical Center on Galveston,
let's
Island.
Let's put in an area that regularly floods. That's a
yes, it is. And it's underwater uh-huh. this morning as
and,
well.
With
and
no
and
power.
Of course, we're also going to be affected because the Houston Ship Canal, which was also vulnerable to the ship surge, is an area where I also used to work. is home to the nation's largest concentration of petrochemical factories and is a major major oil processing port. We're going to get hit, and probably already have been hit, with rising gasoline prices as a result. And it really, once again, makes you question the wisdom of offshore oil drilling.
Yeah.
All right. And then moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, lots of economic news this week, particularly banks in bad trouble. Fannie and Freddie, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Fannie and Freddie bailout. It's been estimated a $25 billion bailout, but it's going to be much, much bigger than that, probably the largest bailout in history. Fannie and Freddie are going to be put under conservatorship. That means that the federal government is going to seize their assets, going to sell off the ones that they think are valuable, and downsize the companies, and probably eventually try to either keep them functioning as much smaller entities, or maybe even get rid of them altogether. Some people have called that nationalizing the two companies. It's really not. It's taking over the companies to reprivatize them. And the difference between that and nationalizing, in nationalizing companies, what usually happens is a government will go in and seize the assets of a company, and because they're valuable and want to keep them on their books and run the companies and collect the profits from the sale of whatever products or services those companies produce. But in this case, what we're doing is we're nationalizing the debt. We're taking on assets that are largely have no value or very, very little value, going to sell off anything that is of value to the private industry. So selling off the good stuff and keeping the bad, and making, in this case, in the case of Fannie and Freddie, making a market in mortgage-backed securities to keep the credit markets afloat and to save banks that own those securities, because most of those securities are owned by banks and foreign governments. So it's not only just an economic issue here at home, it's a world economic issue, and it's also a foreign policy issue that has determined that we have to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Also this week, the Washington Mutual Board fired CEO Kerry Killinger. We could have seen that coming, should have come a lot sooner, particularly since Kerry Killinger had the option to do exactly what Alan Fishman, is the new CEO, is doing, which is sell off some of WaMu's bad assets and try to find a buyer for what's left over. That's something that Killinger had the choice of doing earlier in the year, and instead he decided, no, I'm not going to sell to JP Morgan Chase. I'm going to go find some investors to pour more money more good money after bad into the company. Unfortunately, those investors who bought a portion of Washington Mutual when it was $8.75 a share are crying now that it's between $2 and $3 a share. That almost certainly is what led to Killinger's ouster. And once again, we hear of JP Morgan Chase looking at buying up Washington Mutual, and that's likely to be what's going to happen very soon. Also, Lehman Brothers Bank, the fourth largest investment bank in the country, is headed right in the same direction that Bear Stearns was headed in. They're also scrambling around after declaring a $4 billion loss for the third quarter of this year. They're scrambling around desperately for a buyer. And if they can't do it, I guess the federal government gets to step in again. So that sums up the economic news for this week.
All right. Any other numbers you want to throw at us?
No, I think we'll pass on those.
Okay.
This week.
Then we'll go over to Mr. Parrish, who is was one of the reasons you were gone. You were at the Democratic National Convention.
Yes, it was. And of course, that's kind of become old news at this point. But it was very interesting and very striking being in Denver. Not so much because of the protests, which were something of a letdown, although there were unprovoked crackdowns. Those were actually worse in Minnesota than they were in Denver. But the convention itself, the parts that don't make the television and where all the real business of the convention gets gets done is sort of behind the scenes at the caucus meetings, the parties, the hospitality suites, and so forth. And something that you know intellectually, but you don't really understand until you see it up front, is just how bad the lobbying and the corporate presence is. You see something like, you know, there's 20,000 lobbyists for every human being in Washington, D.C., and you don't really internalize that until you go to Denver and you see something like, you know, the Washington State delegation to the convention, their breakfast in the morning before they even go to the convention, and in subsequent mornings they were sponsored by Eli Lilly and Amgen and some other pharmaceutical company, and then you wonder why we don't have any universal health insurance in this country, and why the Democrats have laid down on telecommunications immunity when another one was sponsored by Quest, and another one was sponsored by Verizon, and so forth. Of course, all the free swag from the corporations too. That was a really striking piece of it. But in watching and observing the two different conventions, and of course the subsequent vice presidential pick of Sarah Palin, there's been a really striking dynamic that has happened in this race the past couple, 3 weeks especially, although we were seeing some inklings of it earlier, with the pick of Sarah Palin as vice presidential pick, and the difference between the Democratic and the Republican conventions, where the Democrats were trying to talk all about issues and you know what they would do on the economy and what they would do in foreign policy and so forth, and they're in a position to do this because the majority of Americans agree with them on most of these issues. The Republicans are not, and so what they have done instead is not only making it a campaign about personalities and about attacking the other side, which is what most of the speeches at the RNC were about, but In the selection of Sarah Palin, I think we're seeing the first truly anti-intellectual presidential campaign we've ever seen. Not just an appeal to emotion, because we've always had appeals to emotion as part of a presidential campaign. I mean, a chicken in every pot was an appeal to emotion. But we're seeing appeals to emotion in the absence of anything else. And we're seeing it in the context of, defining Barack Obama as an other, not just because he's black and you're not, which is a subtext for a fair amount of what the Republicans are saying, but also because he's smart and you're not.
And he can think.
Yeah. Sarah Palin is the American Idol contestant for the most powerful job in the world. She's somebody who is photogenic, who has a charming personality, although, you know, somewhat sarcastic, and really, you could see yourself up there doing what she's doing.
No, actually, I'd do a better job.
Well,
I'm sure,
yes. Well, that's. But I'm talking about for
and the, she's older
for,
than me.
For the average person in a trailer park and in some corner of America, you know, they could see themselves doing what Sarah Palin is doing. Mm-hmm. It's really very frightening, and you have to wonder what the rest of the world is thinking, that they are so much at the mercy of who America elects as its leader, and this is what our political campaigns have devolved to. It's very, very frightening and very, very discouraging, and let's hope it doesn't carry the day in November.
Yeah, there have been many, many things that we've seen about Sarah Palin printed, some of them true, some of them not. I think the most disturbing thing that I've seen is that this week the Senate of Alaska voted to subpoena 13 individuals in the investigation of the firing of the chief public safety officer in Alaska by Sarah Palin. And one of those individuals was her husband, Todd. And in the article I read about it, it appears that Todd Palin gets copied on all of the major emails that are sent about public policy in the state of Alaska, and that he has a lot of control in her government. And to me, that tells me that
God's place for a wife is to obey her husband.
Yeah, that's the main reason not to vote for her. Because, you know, I mean, she clearly isn't doing her work on her own. It's her and her husband. And I'm sorry, but that to me, that's just probably the worst thing I could have ever heard about her.
Yeah, the other thing that's been really striking is the succession of blatant and repeated serial lies that are coming out of the McCain-Palin campaign.
After McCain said that he would never run a dishonest campaign.
Yeah, and you, to their credit, the mainstream media is starting to call them on this, but the McCain campaign is clearly betting on the idea that it doesn't matter if they lie, that that people are going to look at the media calling them on it and saying, well, that's the media, they're being biased, and that they can lie with impunity. And this is the next logical step from what the Bush administration has been doing for the last 8 years. And it's very, very frightening, because if they're running a campaign like this, you can only imagine how they would govern.
Yeah.
Well, didn't they in Washington State just pass a law saying, or pass a judge vote that said lying on a campaign is completely fine?
Yeah, that was actually that was the Supreme Court ruling.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to international and Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, we've seen more reports this week. The United States with troops in Pakistan with more bombings, 12 people reportedly killed yesterday in Pakistan. This has huge foreign policy implications for that part of the world, particularly with a new government being sworn in Pakistan. And it's getting very little attention in the United States because of the presidential campaign and now because of the hurricane. And just keep an eye on that. That's a very serious development.
Yeah, the I think what's interesting too is that Pakistan, with its new government, has been stressing that it would not allow any foreign government to conduct any kind of military exercises on its territory without its approval. And the Bush administration in the past has not ever said that it would do that, that it would always consult with the Pakistani government, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, George Bush has been secretly authorizing U.S. troops to go ahead and pursue military options on Pakistani soil without informing the Pakistani government first. That's a dangerous situation, particularly for U.S. troops in that position, because they could come under fire from Pakistani government troops and they would never know. And Pakistani government troops would never know who they were killing or who they were pursuing. It's an extremely dangerous and volatile situation, and nobody's really calling George Bush on it.
Yeah, and if you remember, a number of months ago, Barack Obama got a lot of criticism from Republicans for saying he'd pursue Osama bin Laden in Pakistan without Pakistani government approval if that scenario were to arise. This isn't pursuing bin Laden. This is simply doing military exercises in Pakistan. If you want to get a hold of us, our email address is info@eatthestate.org.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Yo, check this out, man.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This week in Radical History for the week of September 15th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizers, and other radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, hey!
This week in Radical History for September 15th, 1845. The first mass strike of women workers for a 10-hour workday took place when 5,000 women in textile mills in Pennsylvania walked off the job. The strike, however, was unsuccessful. Also on September 15, 1923, Ku Klux Klan activities in Oklahoma reaches such a high pitch that the governor is forced to declare a state of rebellion and insurrection. History seems to be more than willing to repeat itself as the modern-day KKK, known as neo-Nazi skinheads, are rearing its ugly heads in both the South, but also skinhead strongholds like parts of New Jersey. Also on September 15, 1970, Tricky Dick Nixon orders the CIA to prevent the inauguration of Salvador Allende, a democratically elected president of Chile. They didn't succeed, however. The trickster further authorizes $250,000 to bribe Chilean congressmen. 3 years later, in 1973, folk singer Victor Jara is murdered in a massacre after the U.S. sponsor overthrow of Allende is started. A quote from a Chilean housewife found in the New York Times at the time stated, "Allende's biggest mistake was not giving us weapons. A lot of people, even women, would have fought." The CIA is instrumental in Allende's murder and installing dictator Pinochet, who is responsible for tens of thousands of deaths, most native indigenous darker Chileans, who were in a continuous struggle against the lighter Spanish immigrants who took the lands. Like most of these proxy wars, it really is a struggle about indigenous versus the conquest of their lands. This week in Radical History for September 16, 1915 in Haiti, U.S. takes control of customs and finance of Haiti for 10 years. To protect U.S. plundering interests, I'm sure. And the country becomes bankrupt, once one of the richest countries in this hemisphere. Also on September 16, 1920, in revenge of the prosecution of Sacco and Vassetti, thousands take to the street in dozens of countries around the world. Propaganda the Deed anarchist Mario Buda detonates a horse and buggy bomb at the corner wall on Broad Street in Manhattan in retaliation for Sacco and Vassetti's deaths. The bomb explodes outside the J.P. Morgan Company in New York's Wall Street, causes $2 million worth of damage, and the ensuing fire would destroy Morgan's offices. The Sebra and Shatila massacre happened on this date in 1982, when Israeli Defense Forces, whose General Ariel Sharon is in charge of the Palestinian concentration camp set up by Israel on the border with Lebanon. Sharon would allow the Lebanese faction to enter the camp with arms, massacring perhaps more than 3,500 unarmed Palestinians. That is why, among many other outrages by the Israeli government and members of the Israeli government, why many of them are considered war criminals by many in the Middle East. Though we've invaded Iraq for violating 17 UN resolutions, Israel is in violation of over 40 UN resolutions about their handling of the longest occupation in modern history, the Palestinian occupation. Yet no matter what UN resolutions Israel violates, they get a free pass every time. A free pass to kill, a free pass to occupy, a free pass to demolish homes, a free pass to do whatever they want to the Palestinian people. This week in Radical History for September 17th, 1179, medieval proto-feminist, mystic, poetic visionary, and composer Hildegard of Bingen dies on this date. Known for many things, including some of the music you're hearing in the background right now, eight of the original compositions have survived to this date. Hildegard's visionary writing maintained that virginity is the highest level of spiritual life. However, she also wrote about the secular life, including motherhood. She's the first woman to record a treatise on female sexuality, providing scientific accounts of female orgasms. As a side note, I suspect the 12th century Hildegard would be considered too radical for certain Alaskan governors' sensibilities. Lastly, more sad news for September 17th, 1973 in Chile. At noon today, word had come down that Americans were missing. David Hathaway had been taken from his apartment. Frank Terchugi, American IWW member and journalist, was also unaccounted for. And sometime during that day, Charlie Horman would also be seized. Here's just some of what we know about the U.S. involvement in the disappearance and execution of Americans. Pinochet may have had CIA go-ahead to kill Americans, documents show. The Guardian. Though Chilean authorities never confirmed that Mr. Terchugi was executed, he was arrested in the apartment days after the coup and tortured at the National Stadium, witnesses said. His body was discovered in a morgue 10 days later, riddled with bullet holes. Quote, FBI watched an American who was killed in Chile coup, New York Times.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality.
This week in Radical History for September 18th, only got two items. 1838, under the forced removal order of Indiana, the Potawatomi are delivered to the ironically named Immigrant Agency concentration camps. Also on September 18, 1934, textile workers are out on strike on the East Coast. In all, 1.5 million workers strike in different industries in 1934. A broad anti-war movement is organized in college campuses as well. A nationwide strike against the war in 1934 drew some 25,000 students, whereas a strike in 1936 turned out an estimated 500,000 students.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
This week in radical history for September 19th, I only have two items. 1776, George Washington's farewell address. He strongly warns against permanent alliances with foreign powers, large public debt, large military establishment, and devices of any small, artful, enterprising minority to control or change the government. Also on this date, 1856, U.S. forces invade Panama to protect American interests. To this date, the U.S. has over 700 military bases around the world. All protecting American interests, of course. Guess how many foreign military bases are on our soils? Two more items for this week in radical history for September 20th, 1934. Southern employers continue their big counteroffensive to break the textile labor strike. 10,000 National Guardsmen mobilize, supplemented by 15,000 armed deputies, in an effort to stampede some 421,000 strikers and to force them back to work. Also on that date in 1974, Kootenai Nation in northern Idaho declares war on the U.S. government, with the objective of gaining reservation and tribal housing, roads, and community centers denied to them since the taking of their lands by the U.S. and Canadian governments, whose borders go through the Kootenai Nation's lands. This week in radical history for September 21st, only got three items. 1638, New World. In a final act of the Pequot War, English officials and their Native American allies in Connecticut divide the surviving 72 Pequots and enslave them. The Puritans had lived under an uneasy truce with the Pequot, but they wanted them out of the way so they could take their land. Using the murder of a white trader and Indian kidnapper as an excuse, the English attacked the Indians on Block Island 2 years ago. Realizing the battle with tribal warriors was only one way to destroy their will, the colonists had turned to a terrorist strategy of massacring non-combatants. Before today's slave deal, the war concluded with the English attack on the Mystic River village, where troops led by Captain John Marston killed at least 600 Pequot. Never wanted to be outdone by the Americans, in 1989, Israeli soldiers began a 40-day occupation and house-to-house destruction of the Palestinian town of Beit Sharrum in retaliation for its mass 2 years refusal to pay taxes to the occupying Israeli government. To this day, Israel is still in violation of more UN resolutions than any other country in the world. Let's end on a good note, for on September 21st, 11 years ago, the Daily Bleed website came online. The Daily Bleed website. Awesome work, and thank you, Daily Bleed. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Big thanks to the Slingshot organizer and the Daily Bleed website for both radical info and also radical inspiration. Special thanks to all those radio stations airing my little ditty each and every week, and thanks for all the kind words about this program. This Week in Radical History is produced for other not-for-profit community and micropower radio use worldwide, and is a standalone production produced for the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show. The Mike Cannon Show is a 3-hour weekly indie media radio program. For program info on this or other audio projects I'm involved in, please feel free to contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. So that's all one long run-on word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Got to run. Until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am always and forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
gotta go.
This is 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.